content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is entitled, It's Never Been This Bad, written by Caitlin Dickerson. Since law enforcement agents began their descent on Chicago, acting with seemingly unprecedented speed and ferocity, Evelyn Vargas and her colleagues at Organized Communities Against Deportation have been in a frenzy. They help run an emergency hotline that refers people who have been detained to immigration lawyers and directs their families to support services such as food pantries, emergency housing, and mental health care. And they oversee a team of 35 rapid responders who have been sprinting across the city to film arrests, aiming for at least two to arrive on the scene within 10 minutes. When training volunteers, ORCAD, the Organized Communities Against Deportation, instructs them to stay a safe distance from agents and makes clear that their goal is to observe but not interfere or prevent arrests. They share footage with elected officials and lawyers representing those apprehended, but do not post the videos online, and they emphasize that the safety of everyone involved is their top priority. Despite these precautions, Vargas told me that her colleagues and others doing similar work in Chicago have been thrown to the ground, pepper sprayed, and tailed in their cars by officers in an apparent attempt to intimidate them. A few weeks ago, agents temporarily detained some of their members, all of whom are citizens or legal residents, so Vargas and her colleagues quickly removed them from group chats in case their devices were searched. To protect themselves and their work, they also keep their office location private and have started to ban phones, laptops, and other devices from meetings. No notes are allowed except those taken by lawyers about people who could be targeted by ICE. People interested in joining the group require an invitation and may be asked to participate after attending three meetings, but only if their references check out. Vargas said she worries about what ORCAD's volunteers will face next. This feels pretty bad, she told me. It's so hard to not know if the tailing is just an incremental thing, or if it's going to stop there or keep going. Since Donald Trump and his top aides directed a cavalcade of government agencies and tens of billions of dollars toward their effort to deport immigrants en masse, the advocates defending them have become targets too. Their ranks span levels of experience, funding, and professionalism, from individual lawyers at long-established firms to parent volunteers who walk immigrant children to school. ICE is facing more aggressive challenges to its work than usual, not all of it from groups with clear safety guidelines. But the administration has begun characterizing virtually any opposition as part of an orthodoxy to dox, harm, or even kill ICE agents and upend the rule of law, launching an attack that it promises is just beginning. House Republicans have demanded financial records from nonprofit groups that they accuse of fueling illegal border crossings and training immigrants on how to avoid cooperating with ICE. Trump's Justice Department has sought monetary sanctions against immigration lawyers, and the Department of Education has dangled the possibility of excluding them from public service loan forgiveness programs. The Drug Enforcement Agency and the FBI are investigating the clashes between officers and activists in the streets, and representatives of the Department of Homeland Security say that, along with the IRS, they are tracking what NGOs, unions, and other individuals may be funding with these violent riots. For those who are interacting with ICE directly, the threats are often physical. Hours after a bullet casing inscribed with the phrase anti-ICE was discovered near one of the agency's facilities in Dallas, where two immigrants were killed, one was critically injured last month, Trump declared that characterizing the agency inevitably leads to violence. He then directed the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force to disrupt and dismantle activist groups. But the memo is written so broadly as to include people who have opposing views on capitalism, migration, race, and gender. Many of these so-called advocates are actually engaging in violent and dangerous behavior, Tricia McLaughlin, a DHS spokesperson, told me in a statement. She added, in reference to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, from comparisons to the modern-day Nazi Gestapo to glorifying rioters, the violent rhetoric of these sanctuary politicians is beyond the pale. This rhetoric is contributing to the more than 1,000% surge in assaults of our ICE officers. And yet this comes at a time when ICE itself has become more violent toward immigrants, protesters, and unlucky bystanders alike. In recent weeks, agents have shoved to the ground a journalist trying to document an arrest and a woman who was crying because her husband had just been taken into custody. Both were hospitalized. And in Chicago, they shot a woman who they say rammed an agency vehicle, a claim that the woman's lawyer said body camera footage disproves. Along with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and the FBI, ICE has also stormed an apartment building in the dark of night, breaking down doors and detaining scores of people, including U.S. citizens. Bystanders reported seeing children zip-tied to one another. The administration has said that officers have no choice but to be aggressive when the public attempts to interfere with their work. Secretary Noem has a clear message to rioters, McLaughlin said. You will not stop or slow us down. ICE and CPB will continue to enforce the law. ORCAD does not condone violence under any circumstances, but embraces the leftist viewpoints that Trump often berates. Vargas told me the group supports immigrants regardless of whether they've broken any laws, rejecting the argument that some, typically hard-working parents with no criminal records, deserve empathy and others don't. Its members identify as abolitionists, believing that state investments in marginalized communities would more effectively and humanely counter societal problems than the immigration and criminal justice systems. In their work filming arrests, they take inspiration from the Black Panther Party, which organized cop watch patrols during the 1960s civil rights movement. The administration is bearing down on more mainstream immigrant advocacy groups, too. At the National Immigration Law Center, which has advised Congress and filed precedent-setting litigation for 46 years, staff attorneys have memorized phone numbers to call if they're arrested. We normally do Know Your Rights presentations for immigrants. Now we're doing it for our staff, Kika Matos, the organization's president, told me. I've been doing this work for 20 years, and it's never been this bad. Matos said people are still eagerly coming forward to support the work, but their demographics have changed. Whereas before, rallies her group organized or participated in were attended mostly by immigrants and people of color, she said the last rally I went to, I'd say, was made up of 70 to 75% white folks. Immigrants are too afraid now in many communities to speak out and take part. In the past, an undocumented speaker would often headline those rallies, but now the group makes sure to spotlight only U.S. citizens. Brian House, a First Amendment attorney at the ACLU, told me that listservs connecting tens of thousands of immigration lawyers have been alight with questions about what might trigger the administration to come after them. House said that many are concerned about not having their student loans forgiven after spending years in public service jobs if the administration deems their work to be, quote, supporting terrorism, unquote, or subsidizing illegal immigration, human smuggling, child trafficking, pervasive damage to public property, and disruption of a public order, as a recent executive order warns. In August, Justice Department lawyers filed a motion to financially sanction an attorney who they said made frivolous arguments as he tried to stop the deportation of a man to Laos. The secretary, Joshua Schroeder, challenged the motion. A judge has yet to decide on it. Nobody knows what the lines are anymore. Everybody is asking, if I do this, will I get in trouble? Is this okay or is that okay? And the answers are, I don't know, Haas said. Even if you win in court and are within your rights, there could be a lot of damage done. Some lawyers have had to get lawyers themselves. The Hanna Center, which serves about 16,000 immigrants a year in Chicago and created an app that can send a message to your emergency contact or notify your consulate if you encounter ICE, reinforced its cybersecurity system and hired lawyers to review social media posts and press releases, according to its executive director, Danae Kovac. Karen Musolo, the director for the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Law San Francisco, secured pro bono counsel to respond to her organization's behalf, on their behalf, when it was one of more than 200 groups probed by the House Homeland Security Committee. Musolo called the inquiry performative for the MAGA base and an attempt to intimidate her staff, adding that her attorneys remain steadfast. To be intimidated against doing what one thinks is ethical and principled because of the threat of retaliation is cowardice at its core, she told me. I don't want to live in a society where everyone capitulates. Some, however, have capitulated, particularly among the elite. Big law firms once dedicated enormous resources from their pro bono departments to defending immigrants against the government. But soon after Trump retook office, he began singling out those firms in executive orders that, if implemented, would have obliterated their businesses. Several struck deals in exchange for having orders against them dropped. Collectively, they have agreed to about $1 billion in free legal work on causes that the president supports. Even firms that were not explicitly targeted in executive orders have scaled back their pro bono work on immigration cases in what one lawyer described to the New York Times as anticipatory obedience. Despite the intense pressure that ORCAD is facing, Vargas told me the organization doesn't plan to stop. Nor, she said, does it long for the days before Trump was elected, when ICE carried out arrests that separated families and made their friends and neighbors live in fear, only with less fanfare. Many of the group's members began advocating for immigrants' rights when they were college students. They've never seen this level of aggression, but across Republican and Democratic administrations, they have experienced punishing periods of ICE enforcement. Vargas said she shudders to hear some people speak wistfully about the past, when the immigration system was still broken, but the public debate over it was completely dispassionate. These discussions are about the subjugation and opposition of me, she said. If you want to have a calm conviction about it, I'm so glad you feel safe enough to do that. I am not. Our second story. The right is suddenly obsessed with heritage Americans. Written by Allie Breland. In August, a guest on Tucker Carlson's podcast said something that immediately caught his interest. The United States faces a fundamental rift between heritage Americans and the new political class, Orrin McIntyre, a columnist for Blaze Media, argued. Heritage Americans, what are those? Carlson asked. You could find their last names in the Civil War registry, McIntyre explained. This ancestry matters, he said, because America is not a collection of abstract things agreed to in some social contract. It is a specific set of people who embody an, quote, Anglo-Protestant spirit, end quote, and have a tie to history and to the land. McIntyre continued, if you change the people, you change the culture. All true, Carlson replied. That same phrase, Heritage American, has been rippling across the right, particularly on the social web. Politicians have started flirting with the idea as well. During a speech at the Claremont Institute in July, Vice President J.D. Vance said that people whose ancestors fought in the Civil War have a hell of a lot more claim over America than the people who say they don't belong, referring to those on the modern left who conceive of American identity purely as an idea. And here's Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri at the National Conservative Conference last month. "We Americans are the sons and daughters of the Christian pilgrims that poured out from Europe's shores to baptize a new world in their ancient faith. America," Schmidt said, "is our birthright. It's our heritage, our destiny." Spokespeople for Vance and Schmidt did not respond to requests for comment, nor did Carlson or McIntyre. The question of who counts as American has been debated for generations, and people have answered it in different ways in various eras, often depending on their own background and ideology. C.J. Engel, a self-described heritage American, whom Politico credits as having helped popularize the term, has repeatedly said that he is not a racial essentialist and believes that Blacks of the Old South and integrated Native Americans also count as heritage Americans. But he also argued that the majority of Blacks have demonstrated that they cannot function within the old European cultural standards, and that the concept of heritage Americans affirms the domination and preeminence of the European-derived peoples, their institutions, and their way of life. When I called Engel to ask him about all of this, he told me that he does not believe that genetics are the chief explanation for how Anglo-Protestant ideals are transferred from generation to generation, but added that there is an ethnic or racial correlation between who embodies such ideals and who doesn't. Our conversation was polite, but strange at times. I mentioned that as a half-Iranian-American who was born and raised in the U.S., I share more in common ideologically with the Anglo-Protestant founders of the United States than I do with Middle Eastern theocrats. I would also contend that there is something deep inside of you that is attracted to or finds familiar portions of Iranian history, he said, as though I am genetically predisposed to find the conquests of Darius the Great uniquely moving. I don't, and I told him as much. I'm not contending that you can't take someone and raise him within a certain cultural environment, and he begins to adopt the taste and all that, Engel responded, but I do contend that if you bring in massive groups of people over time, it's going to, in a few generations, be a lot culturally different than it would be otherwise have you had never done that. Speaking with Engel reminds me at times of McIntyre, Vance, and others who tend to speak in nativist terms. They frequently appeal to an idea that only some Americans are truly legitimate, and often this means Americans of European ancestry, while leaving room for enough plausible deniability and to avoid seeming straightforwardly racist. During his conversation with Tucker Carlson, McIntyre made the point that although one's Americanness is tied to blood in the land, that doesn't mean that other people can't be grafted in. In the same speech in which Vance connected American identity to ancestry, the vice president also defended some immigrants. "My lovely wife is the daughter of immigrants to this country," he said, "and I am certainly better off, and I believe our whole country is better off for it." The far-right writer and podcaster Scott Greer said this plainly. "Liberals look stupid when they freak out over such an anodyne term. He wrote in the August column for the American Conservative, endorsing the term. This vagueness is strategically useful, he argued, because heritage American is more palatable to the public than white. In 2018, The Atlantic revealed that Greer wrote under a pen name for a journal run by the white supremacist Richard Spencer. He later apologized and said that his views had evolved. The term has also obvious potency as the Trump administration enacts mass deportations of undocumented immigrants and pursues a project of redefining America more broadly. Immediately upon returning to office in January, the president signed an executive order to reinterpret the 14th Amendment to ban birthright citizenship, the legality of which is still being debated in the courts. Heritage Americans seems engineered to move the goalposts even further. A lot of people are asking, okay, we understand mass deportations for illegals. We get that, McIntyre said to Carlson. But what about legal immigrants? How does that work? Who is an American ultimately? Right? And that's really going to be the question of our age. When Engel and I spoke, he ran through a list of possible immigration restrictions that he would pair with ongoing mass deportations. He seemed to recognize that America can't deport everyone. We need to be realistic and we can't turn back the past, he said. But in politics, especially on the right, new buzzwords can signal what policy goals are coming. Backlash to critical race theory and groomers that started online helped galvanize a real-life movement to strip discussions about race and LGBTQ matters from school curricula. The rise of the rhetoric about the Great Replacement, the conspiracy theory that there is an intentional plot to replace white people with people of color, helped supercharge support for mass deportations among American voters. Heritage Americans is similarly a framework that gestures to an intellectual justification for policy, Nicole Hemmer, a historian at Vanderbilt who studies the right, told me. Taken to the extreme, some of these same ideas lead to remigration, the notion that non-white citizens who haven't properly assimilated should be deported. Remigration has already gained traction among the nativist right in Europe. President Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Stephen Miller have already floated the concept as a potential solution to what they see as America's immigration problems. And in May, the State Department announced that as part of a pivot away from refugee resettlement within the U.S., it would create an Office of Remigration. Over the summer, Trump posted a lengthy message on Truth Social about his desire to put the full force of his administration behind his goal to reverse the tide of mass destruction migration that has turned once idyllic towns into scenes of third world dystopia. The president went on, "Our federal government will continue to be focused on the re-migration of aliens to the places from where they came, and preventing the admission of anyone who undermines the domestic tranquility of the United States." Our next story, Coffee is in Trouble, by Ellen Cushing. Coffee is in trouble. Even before the United States imposed tariffs on 50%, of 50% on Brazil and 20% on Vietnam, which together produce more than half of the world's coffee beans. Other challenges, including climate change-related fires, flooding, and droughts, had already forced up coffee prices globally. Today, all told, coffee in the U.S. is nearly 40% more expensive than it was a year ago. Futures for Arabica coffee, the beans most people in the world drink, have increased almost a dollar since July. And prices may well go up further. Tariffs have destabilized an already volatile market. Sarah Morochi, the CEO of the coffee consultancy Vuna, told me, "This is a problem for the millions of people who grow and sell coffee around the world. It is also a problem for the people who rely on coffee for their base executive functioning, such a problem that Congress recently introduced a bipartisan bill to specifically protect coffee from Trump's tariffs." Coffee is a bit of a funny place from which to start trying to legislate against import taxes. Many, many foods and drinks are currently being tariffed to outer space. But coffee has basically no nutritional value and plenty of functional substitutes. Walk into any gas station and you will see a wall full of energy drinks in every flavor, color, and chemical composition. We do not need coffee. But of course we need it. This is precisely why Ro Khanna, the North Carolina Democrat, North California Democrat, who is sponsoring the bill, along with Don Bacon, a Republican from Nebraska, introduced the No Coffee Tax Act, he told me. He had been talking a lot on cable news about the dangers posed by tariffs, but the message wasn't getting through. Coffee is a vivid and concrete way into a broader conversation about what import taxes actually do. This is something that a lot of people have in their house, he said. They've noticed that it's more expensive. The cost of coffee really matters to people. He pointed out that Americans have historically proved themselves willing to go to war over high taxes on what's in their mug in the morning, and that President Richard Nixon, when he imposed wide-ranging tariffs in 1971, exempted coffee. Coffee is fixed in our culture, our economy, our rituals, and our brain chemistry. It is the country's most consumed beverage aside from water, and its psychoactive ingredient, caffeine, is by far the most popular drug on Earth. If human beings weren't so addicted to it, coffee would make no sense as a mass-produced crop. It prefers rocky soil and high altitudes, where mechanization becomes very difficult. For that reason, coffee is typically picked by hand. After that, it is dried, hauled, cleaned, sorted, graded, and roasted, often by people making poverty wages, before it is shipped around the world, and even then it is not ready to drink. Coffee is the driver of a great deal of work, and also the product of it. We really have a strange disjuncture, where coffee is both too cheap and way too expensive. I did have to edit that last article because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you.